Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome someone to the Salyer Report. I've wanted on for quite a while, so I'm very excited about this. I want to introduce you to Professor Daryl Hamamoto, who is a professor at UC Davis in Asian American Studies. He's a real expert in cultural analysis and cross-cultural analysis. His areas of expertise cover lots of topics within that media, pop culture, sexuality. He has a very masterful understanding of the mechanisms of covert influence and manipulation, which, of course, at this point are never ending in our society. So it's a real pleasure to welcome him. Professor Hamamoto, welcome to the Salyer Report, and thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Thank you so much, Catherine. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
How are we going to stop us?
You know, I was really, I was reading your bio, and I was really touched by the story of Bennett College.
It was started by
emancipated slaves.
Oh, I think you're thinking, you're thinking of Bennett College in North Carolina?
Yeah, isn't that where you attended school?
No, there was a Bennett College in Millbrook, New York.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, but... The same principle. I'm in education, so when I read stories like this, I think back. I said, wow, this is what education used to be about. Like people just kind of pulling themselves up and trying to better themselves in the society. And
unfortunately, Bennett College was created for the daughters of wealthy
yes.
families that couldn't get into Radcliffe.
Right. I know, and Brandeis is the same way, but the same principle obtains. People who are, you know, excluded in some fashion, even though they might be privileged, find a means of bettering their position within the society.
Yeah.
I think that's a valuable lesson for all of us.
I loved Bennett College. Unfortunately, it didn't survive. You know, the transition to, you know, it was a women's school, so there's a lot of those that went the way of the world. Well, we're going to talk today about something I've studied a lot and I'm very interested in, and that is the relationship, the economic model of universities and the relationship to high-level fraud of various kinds and really social control, because I see the university as being an extremely important vehicle to do many different things involved in sort of the model that is used to manage and control society. But the economics are very much a part of that. And of course, you know, I grew up in and around universities because of what my family did, but I've never been a professor. You have. So, and you've had quite an education, and I can tell you've really looked into this topic. So why don't we start off, and why don't I ask you, how did you get interested in looking at the real economic model behind both public and private universities? We're going to talk about both today.
Well, like a lot of people who go into education, I went into it naive, idealistic, and had a romantic view of it. But as the quarters and the years wore on, I got to see there were a great deal of contradictions I was being met with, to put it politely. And then it really started to intensify when Janet Napolitano, coming out of the scandals at the Department of Justice, was slotted into the presidency of the University of California system in Oakland, California.
You must have been absolutely amazed.
It's amazing. Long before that, I knew that the University of California was part of a larger program. But the point is that these little turning points in my life only intensified my curiosity and put my research skills, which, you know, I have excellent training in them from the University of California, by the way, Irvine, I put them to use in trying to really, really find out the inner history and politics of the University of California system as being emblematic of the larger American financial empire. And they have a beautiful front that's been set up for them. They use students and the professors, and our ranks are diminishing, the professoriate, as window dressing while they can engage in high-level financial crimes, which we're going to be talking about today.
Well, what I found was the students, and you know, there's many different aspects to the models, but one of the most important at both public and private universities is the professors publish and consult and create intellectual air cover for the various things they want to do, as well as research for a tremendous number of things that the national security state needs and wants. And by keeping it separate in a highly regarded academic environment, they create a credibility for many things that otherwise, you know, you would never be able to get done or just wouldn't have very much credibility. So it's a
yeah, it does provide that veil of legitimacy.
Right.
In a way, it's kind of like the Vatican. Any number of incredible shenanigans, financial and otherwise, can be done in the name of research, under the cover of research. Now, I find out that not in addition to funded research, which is outright hostile to human life and survival on the planet, we also have, I think, the majority of the professoriate, including your basic English and humanities professors and social sciences, who go into their work in good faith, but then their work, their research, which is funded by a limited number of academic publishers owned by the globalists and the banks, once it gets through that hurdle, the big boys at the top of the pyramid, above the professoriate, say, okay, how can we take this information, flip it
right.
on its head? How can we weaponize it? And that was
right.
one of the big turning points. I mean, I started out in Asian American studies, ethnic studies, and at the time, it had a purpose, and it served a very important political function, as well as an academic and intellectual historical function. And then I was finding all these different Asian American opportunists that were rising to the top of the corporate heap. I mean, you know, you're in the financial world. You probably saw over the course of your career the entree of mostly South Asian people with PhDs in physics, who had no financial background. They're known as quants, as you know, who develop
right.
these elaborate, sophisticated, incomprehensible financial models that they can use to boondoggle suckers, people who manage,
right.
well, they're not suckers, they're complicit, the people who run
right.
these pension funds, like the University of California Pension Fund. So that's what was an eye-opener for me, and I wrote a book on it. It's called Servitors of Empire, and I identify any number of high-level Asian Americans who've gone to the very top of corporate the corporate world, as well as the government world. And
yeah, well,
boy,
one thing
did
I
get it. I'm sorry. my world started to crumble at that point because they said, hey, listen, we hired you to be protective air cover, as you put it, right?
Right.
And I said, oh, no, we've met the enemy and they is us, as Pogo said, Walt Kelly.
I never forget, I was sitting on the board of Sallie Mae, which is the securitizer of student loans.
Mm-hmm.
And this was back in the 90s before it went ballistic. In fact, I have an article about it going ballistic called The Economic Hitman of Student Loans. But that's a topic that we'll cover today. So I'm sitting on the board, and Sallie Mae had started to do derivatives, and the financial office made a very impressive presentation. Of course, the board included one-third vice chairmen of the big banks, and what came out in the conversation is none of the vice chairmen understood how the derivatives work. and what I appreciate is how important the whole quants were to creating these models that, of course, were then used to do something else. So if you go back and you look at the housing bubble, you know,
mm-hmm.
the rating agencies approved and rated everything based on what the quant model said. But, of course, what was really going on had nothing to do with
mm-hmm.
with the reality that the quant models had first been based on.
Of course,
so, you know,
not.
You,
and as you probably know, that wasn't really it was just magic. It was just sort of a trick, right? Just
right.
baffle them with formula.
Yeah, the P's over here. So just keep
mm-hmm.
following the P, and the P's over here. The other thing I think that universities are very important to do is to stream and vet and process talent. So in my experience, the people who run, you know, my nickname for the people who run the planet is Mr. Global. Mr. Global spends a fantastic amount of time tracking and using and picking the best talent. And the universities are absolutely critical for funneling, testing, analyzing, you know, using that talent and making sure the best talent goes where you want it to help your, you know, your syndicate grow. And so every university is plugged into all sorts of private investment syndicates, and you know, they're very, very they put tremendous emphasis on sort of sucking up all of that talent and making sure the university send it in the right direction.
Absolutely. And in conversation with my students who are bright and motivated, and they largely are of immigrant or refugee origin, so they're very ambitious. But in talking to them one-to-one, I find out that they've been tracked as early as junior high school or middle high school.
Oh, yeah.
There are people go in there, especially in the STEM areas, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and they're looking for girls and women in particular to stream them. And if you extend that, then that tells you where the big investment is heading, right? The new investment bubble being pumped up. But they need intellectual labor, and they need Asian and Asian American intellectual labor in particular, because as you know, the public school system has been purposely imploded over the past 30 years or so. So immigration, right, overseas intellectual labor becomes even more crucial in filling that need, that labor need. So when I'm lecturing about and telling these students this and just kind of laying out the master plan, the big picture for them, when they have been led into the university system with the idea that this is the way that they're going to make it, and I'm just saying, listen, no, you are sort of like a truffle-sniffing dog. You're there to find the business and the wealth for the big boys. They're going to dig it up and give you a bone. Right, that's it. And then when your lifespan is over, they're going to come in and you're going to train your replacement. That's how it works. And, you know, your average 19, 20-year-old doesn't want to hear that. They believe in the dream. And that's, again, where I run into trouble, because these students are also doped up on Prozac and selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, especially the women, by the way. This is the real gender war, the target of...
Even the immigrants are taking those drugs?
Well, not as much. Okay, this is an interesting sidebar. Not as much as the rest of the population. So I have a colleague who has a whole National Institute of Mental Illness. It's called Mental Health, but I call it Mental Illness. He's got a $1.5 million program in place at UC Davis with the specific intention of pimping out these young, vital people who are ambitious and talented and brilliant, pimping them out to the big pharmaceutical combines. So it's a matter of controlling them, stifling them, and shunting them into a specific life of sort of narcotic stupor while they're doing their job.
Right.
And it's also a means of control. If they ever decide to leave the reservation, so to speak, they can pull out the mental health records.
See? Right.
So they've war gamed this. They, meaning the intelligence, the University of California, the high level planners, not your average professor. This is what I want to make clear: is that the professors, most of them are dupes. Most of them are very frightened, dupes, uninformed, and don't have any understanding outside of their little narrow specialty. So this is what's going on here, and as you probably know, just looking around at any campus, at my campus, for example, almost 40% of the students are Asian and Asian American, and they're really, really targeting talent from China, undergraduate China. That's their new cash cow. And on the other hand, they're going to subsidize illegal immigrant children, you know, the children of illegal immigrants to the University of California. They have a mechanism set up there. So there's an elaborate model, higher education model for the UC system that's been put in place. And because I'm familiar with this literature and reading your work as well, by the way, when the social historians write the history of the Reagan period up to current, they're going to look at your e-book. They're going to look at that. They're going to read it very closely. And that's going to be a very, very important influence. And from an insider, from someone who lived through this very, very important epical moment in our national history. So
well,
I know
I'm
this material. Pardon me?
I'm glad. You go ahead.
Yeah. No. I used text-to-speech last night. Okay, I'm lazy. And I was listening for like 3, 4 hours. I went through every
really?
single. Oh, yes, because it covers a lot of the areas that I'm interested as well in.
Well, I'm glad you said that because you have serious research training and experience. And one of the reasons I did that, I did the Dylan Reed story, was I felt there was a need for something that was heavily footnoted and impeccable in terms of presentation and documentation. I'm sure you didn't go look at the footnotes in the and the resource center, but there's literally tens of thousands of pages of legal documents behind it. And that's because, so many good pieces that go to the same topics have been poo-pooed. And by collecting up all the SEC and investment documents and putting it behind it, I felt that we just needed one case study that was impeccable in terms of, but I'm not an academic. I
No,
was a terrible
it's
student.
impeccable. It is impeccable. It is tight. And I said, this should be a book. And I thank you for documenting this. This is so important, and I'm going to spread it around to my colleagues. I said,
Oh, good. Okay.
you want to know what's been going on for the past 30 years? Check this out. And speaking, you talk a lot about the prison industrial complex. I mean, you were there
Right.
at the inception in the early 90s with the Cornell Corrections. Well, we have something analogous going on here. We have a mental health prison system that's, like I just alluded to previously, I have a colleague who gets $1.5 million to put this infrastructure in place. But this is a prison without beds, a prison without walls. It's an
Right.
electropharmaceutical prison.
I
And they're
call it
going to re
free-range totalitarianism.
free-range chicken necks, yeah.
Right.
That's what's happening, and the thing is that they won't have to
Yes.
invest anything in infrastructure. No prison
Right.
guards, no prison guard unions, no brick and mortar, no debased food. People are walking around, as you say, free range. And
And they have to support themselves and tithe. So they
exactly,
support themselves, they tithe. So you're
they
making
tithe,
money on each hamster, and
coming
you've
and
got a
going.
smartphone, and you've got them online 24/7 between the smart meters and the phone, and you've got them on drugs, and you're right.
GMOs,
It's, yep,
and you're
yep.
assaulting them from the sky with the chemtrails. So,
Right.
Catherine, I'm teaching all this in the classes. I teach A Course in Sexuality and talk about lowered fertility rates, reproduction, sterility, the engineering of GLBTQ people at the physiological level. This does not make the university happy because this attacks all the big boys that they work for. And I'm sure the orders have come down from on high. Get this Hamamoto guy out of here. So all that means is that I've been upping my social media game and trying to do as
Right.
much alternative media interviews as possible, and to
Right.
get the word out.
Well, I have had professors tell me that they have a box at the door and people have to leave their smartphone in the box because they refuse to teach with the smartphones and anybody connected and online who's in the classroom because they said it's pointless. You can't teach, you can't create a connection intellectually or spiritually or emotionally or culturally if everybody's plugged into the machine.
I agree completely. The whole idea of a classroom experience is that you're communicating, you're having a conversation with the professor, with the students, right across the board. That's the whole purpose of it. And
Right.
it's odd that you would mention that scenario. I wouldn't be able to get away with that. Collecting the cell phones. In fact, one of the reasons why I was called up for a full-length, full-blown university investigation was because I reprimanded somebody for using a cell phone. So, because I've been teaching for about 30 years now, and I'm not used to that level of disrespect, disregard, and but and looking into youth culture, this is another area that I'm looking into recently, children's television programming and sort of anti-family, anti-religion, and anti-health programming that kids are being
Right.
subjected to, because I wanted to find out where was this coming from, And it's a whole culture, it's a whole cultural apparatus that's being foisted on children. So by the time they come to my classroom, they are utterly contemptuous of me, of the education process, of the university. It's been flipped on its head. In fact, throughout my campus, UC Davis, there are literally a bunch of sculptures by a guy named Robert Arneson, I'm sure he has some sort of occult affiliations in the Bay Area, of these Illuminati heads that are upside down, which are a visual mockery of the entire university process. And that's not what I was trained for. I think most people who enter academia, until they're bought off by the administration, enter it with the best of intentions. And we find out, just as you did when you went into the financial world, that that's really not the point. The point is to grasp and to screw over people as much as possible and see if you can make it to the finish line intact. And most of them don't.
Let me come back to the model, because if you
Yes, please.
I want to go to the private model in a second, but if you look at the public model, the public model is really designed to capture and maximize state and local taxes. You know, it gets federal taxes too, but you're trying to get, whereas the private model captures the private dollars and public dollars, the big state university captures a tremendous amount of state and local tax money as well as federal money, and then it engineers it not to optimize the state culture, economy, well-being, but this more centralized agenda. And it's interesting. I just met with a professor from a state university who was in a state of shock and fear, because several of the scientific departments had literally, American students had basically been phased out, and everyone was from China.
Absolutely. And
it looked as though the Chinese space program, they had mostly Chinese, looked like this, the Chinese and Indian space programs were being educated via the state university, and the state legislatures had no idea this was going on.
Yeah, so we're subsidizing foreign governments, and we're subsidizing their militaries and scientific infrastructure.
Right.
So our
right.
industry, just like the automobile industry, the intellectual industry is being hollowed out in the same process, but it's being done in a far less visible fashion.
Right.
And you've been able to figure that out. And also, you know, there are technologies that are just being outright transferred to foreign governments. And this happened under the Clinton administration during, and you've written about this, during the Chinagate hearings, right? And I read about that in my book as well. And by the way, there are any number of Asian Americans who were put in place there to act as air cover, so that if you call them on it, they can say, hey, what's wrong with you? Are you racist against Asian people?
Right,
like what's her name? Ellen. She was Secretary of Treasury. Forgot her name.
Elaine Chao.
Yeah, there you go.
And then there's
Wendy Lee Graham, who has a PhD in economics, by the way. He was married to Phil Graham. That power couple was responsible for the overturn of Glass-Steagall, isn't that right?
Right.
Okay.
Wendy,
so
was
call,
at the Commodities Trade Future Exchange.
So if you criticize her, say, what's the matter? Are you sexist? Are you racist against the Asian American? So, you know, we're kind of like over that scam, and that's why I wrote this book, Servitors of Empire, to just say, hey, no, I'm not going to play the ethnic game anymore, you know.
Right.
Whatever ethnic group it is, whatever gender you are, we're not going to fall for it. Don't try to guilt trip us. You know, we're past the crisis point here, and we're going to take back the republic by getting over this this ugly history that we've experienced in the last
right. It's really human
decades.
Against transhuman or machine.
That is the end game.
Yeah, that's
those
the
scientists,
end
game. Those brains who are in these classes now. Are talking about AI. They're talking about high-level robotics, not the friendly Robbie the Robot types, but, you know, just really high-end thinking and behaving machines. And that's what they're workshopping right now. The whole sort of LGBTQ movement is just sort of a way station into that end game right there. And, of course, as you pointed out, it's very much related to the population reduction strategy, eugenics, and just sort of the obdurate hate that these super elites have for humanity. It's just an expression of the complete disdain that they have for everyday people.
Right. And part of it is, are we running society for, you know, are we trying to optimize the human experience, or are we trying to optimize the dividend that the Earth produces for Mr. Global? I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And I
Mr. Global seems to be having the his fun and the upper hand at this point, but perhaps we can
turn
it
around.
We can turn around and we can talk specifically about what I've been working around to turn it around, because I don't want to just diagnose the problem. I want to help the young people envision something new for them. And I'm saying, listen, you're from the Asian world. This is where the economic growth is happening. You have the language skills. You have the family and the cultural background. You should retain that, and you should explore it and deepen and intensify that, rather than going joining some large corporation that's going to fire you after they've milked you dry. So
right.
I'm saying, and I have a very close relationship, by the way, with a colleague who's Vietnamese-speaking, and we're presenting a model, a small model, at UC Davis, and the administration is really greedily trying to wrest it away from my colleague here. But we're looking at Vietnam specifically as an opportunity, as a growth opportunity, as an investment opportunity for what I call the heritage economy. Okay, this is I'm introducing this concept to your subscriber right now, Gavin.
And Vietnam is a wonderful place to do it. I just finished reviewing two books on the South China Sea on my website and revisited sort of Vietnam, its geography, its economy. It's a wonderful
resources,
place to do that.
Yeah. And its people and its cultural heritage and its spirit.
Right.
And maybe you and I should talk privately about this at some
point. I would love to. I think that sounds very exciting.
Because the university would try to fire me if they found out if I had some sort of side business going on, even though Linda Cadet is getting hundreds of thousands of dollars as a quote-unquote board member, right? You know how that works.
Well,
so,
I think,
yeah,
you know, Vietnam has a great future because the United States has a strategic need to make sure that the East Asian countries are secure, and Vietnam and South Korea are both in very strategic positions, as you well know. Anyway, so to the next topic, let's talk about the private model, because I want to start off with a story that I've never told on the Solari Report, but I'm going to tell it to you because I want to communicate how extraordinary the central control is. It's so extraordinary, and part of it, of course, is all this free-range totalitarianism technology. But when I was litigating with the federal government, you know, Harvard Endowment was very much involved in the corruption in the housing bubble. And so I really dug in and started to research the Harvard Corporation and what the endowment was doing and how it related to various policies that the academics at Harvard were pushing. And I really dug in and tried to, another researcher and I published something called the Harvard Data Dump. And we were just, as a network, trying to figure out, okay, how does this model work? And let's find some case studies. And it ended up turning out into an enormous amount of research that went into the students at Harvard who created something called Harvard Watch, sort of outing the whole Enron story. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so as, you know, I contributed to it, and of course it outed a lot of very things that, of course, I think the university and the corporation didn't want coming out. And anyway, so while it was going on, I at one point had raised a great deal of money for the University of Pennsylvania. I was a board member of Arts and Sciences and the graduate board at Wharton, and my family's been very involved with Penn for three generations. So Penn kept writing me for donations, and of course I'm spending millions of dollars of litigation, so I'm not very much of a prospect. But I thought, well, you know, I shouldn't keep giving my tiny little amounts of money to University of Pennsylvania and not have the integrity to look at their endowment. So I, you know, by law, any not-for-profit is required to give 3 years of tax returns, you know, publicly. And they didn't have it on their website. So I just wrote and said, you know, please send me the 3 years of tax returns, and didn't think anything of it other than, well, I really ought to have integrity to look, you know, to understand how the money works at the guys I'm giving money to. So I don't get anything. And so I have my attorney write a letter and say, okay, can we get 3 years of tax returns? And about, I don't know, a couple weeks later, I get a call from a relative who's an attorney screaming that if I don't cease and desist right now, that the provost of the University of Pennsylvania has called in my brother, who at the time was the dean of the law school, and threatened him
no.
With dismissal. Now, I think this person was exaggerating. So, but threatened him with dismissal.
It was a threat.
I didn't cease and desist. Well, I think I bet you my brother was exaggerating.
Oh,
anyway,
okay.
but what she said was, if I didn't cease and desist immediately, the family would organize, cut off all support, and as a result, one or more of my attorneys would drop, and I'd end up in prison, and they would basically destroy me if I asked for the University of Pennsylvania's endowment. Now,
no, this is serious high level gangsterism
right.
You're dealing with. Yeah,
right. So here we have an alum who's given. I've raised more than $100,000 at least for the university. I gave a term chair at one. I funded a term chair at one point personally. And the university is basically threatening me with destruction if I dare to ask for what should be just normal public disclosure to any alum.
It's a public institution anyway, right? The University of Pennsylvania. It's not private institution.
No, it is a private institution.
Oh, it is. Okay, I'm sorry.
They do receive appropriations from the state, or they used to.
Okay.
And the federal government, of course, they do significant federal research, including intelligence agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. It's supposed to be completely public.
Wow.
No, in some universities you go in and on their website, it's public disclosure. I mean, I think best practice is it should automatically be public disclosure on any university website.
Catherine, even with your experience in corporate, in the corporate high finance area, you ask that question with the honest expectation that they were going to respond to you. You didn't know what can of worms that you were opening up?
It never occurred to me that they would be that afraid.
You didn't think some guy in a tweed jacket and a rep tie would come after you like a mafia don?
Well, don't laugh. I had a friend in Philadelphia who I was visiting, and I was down at one of the grocery stores next to the university, and a guy who I believe, because I've seen him before, I know who he is, worked in the endowment office. He worked in the investment side. Walked up, and I walked into a line, and he was standing in front of me. He got so nervous by me being there that he literally had to leave and go to another line.
Oh, my God.
He was afraid he'd be fired if somebody took a photo of him with me.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I say that just to tell you how fragile, you think all these people have power, because they have a job. A university professor gets paid $400,000. They have a job. But the whole system is so unbelievably fragile because it's sitting on a pile of, its real model is so different than the official model that and it's so centrally controlled that people are very, very afraid.
They are. I found out in my dealings with administration that in a one-on-one setup, they're really softies. Because, I don't know about the finance people, but the administrators, they come from academia. And
right.
Most of them are pretty wimpy. They, they didn't go to law school or go to B school or anything. So, they were like English professors or professors
right.
of chemistry or something. So they're basically nerds, right? And so you deal with these people. I said, all you have is your little academic personnel model. You can't deal with me. You can't handle
me.
Well,
the thing that's most frightening to me about the universities is not the national security state research. The most frightening thing I've seen so far, and I describe this in my article, The Economic Hitman of Student Loans,
is
basically the bankrupting of generations of American children.
Sure.
Because when you bankrupt a generation, you bankrupt the future. You're not just bankrupting, the children. You're bankrupting the whole future of the country. And a country that's given you, wherever you come from and whatever you're doing, many economic blessings. How could you do that? And for the universities,
let's take it one step further. I think this is deliberate.
Oh, I absolutely agree.
This is part of the program. This is part of the globalist program. They do not want bright, educated, enlightened, and wealthy, and intelligent people who can break it down in any position of power. This is the biggest threat to them. As you mentioned, they're weak, they're fragile. The whole model is a house of cards. You want these people running around that can destroy you? No, you destroy them, you put them in a permanent debt bondage and make tons of money in the process.
Right.
That's exactly what's going on here. It's generational,
right.
And it's not just undergraduates.
Yeah. Right. The universities have been.
It's medical doctors, it's
complicit.
Lawyers, it's business school people. It's the whole, it's
right.
The whole professional class as well. Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the private model. Here's how the private model works that I've found.
Mm-hmm.
If I build a large pool of intergenerational wealth that's subject to taxes, I have to pay taxes on my realized capital gains. I have to pay taxes on my income. There's inheritance taxes. But if I put it in a foundation or a university endowment, then I have in an intergenerational pool of capital, I have a self-perpetuating board. So if you look at the Harvard Corporation, the Yale Corporation, they choose, you know, somebody resigns, they choose the successor. So it's self-perpetuating.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do is I take, say, 4 or 5% a year, and I use that to fund a school that does all these other things we're talking about. It does the research I need to justify where my investment syndicate goes. It makes sure we channel and get the best talent going to our companies. But now I have my capital available to pool and finance my private and public corporations and the rise of the multinational corporation on a tax-free basis.
Mm-hmm.
So, and if you look at the money I'm paying for the school, you know, it's a tiny amount of what I would pay if I had to pay taxes. So, and not only that, it gives me all sorts of legitimacy and research and intellectual air cover, as well as an unending supply of students. So when you look at it, it is phenomenally economic. Then you pull into it the federal, state, and local money that some of the private universities get. Now, you can't get as much as if you add a public university, because then you can capture many more governmental dollars. And between both the public and private, you've basically created this phenomenally economic machine that fuels your rise as an investment syndicate. And, you know, it's making you money. It's not costing you money. It's making you money. And it's it completely gets you out of paying taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the people to pay the taxes, and then they fuel your capital and all, you know, your financial capital, your intellectual capital, and it's just another way you leverage their hard work.
Yeah, and all those benefits and advantages are transferred multi-generationally, while the
right.
rest of us are just trying to scratch and claw our way. Or to maintain basic middle-class status, which is...
Well, I have to confess, I went to the University of Pennsylvania on scholarship because my father worked there. And I promise
oh.
you, Professor Hamamoto, that I would never have gotten in if my would never have gotten into Wharton if my grandfather hadn't been dean of Wharton. So,
well, this is called legacy, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's
so
affirmative action for the connected...
Right, right. Well, believe it or not, it was really funny because the dean of admission was a fabulous guy. He was an African American at the time. He's on the and he was. I ran a bar next to the University of Pennsylvania. He's one of my best bar customers, and I used to say, Charlie, if you don't get me into Wharton, I'll cut you off. Upon which point, he decided I'd probably make a good investment banker, but he got
right.
me in on an affirmative action program. So. You know, I'm the worst of all worlds. I was affirmative action, plus I was legacy benefits, plus...
mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to redeem myself by interviewing you.
Well, you know, it's really your story is fascinating. Your personal, your individual story, your odyssey is just fascinating reading. But it's an object lesson to the wannabes, the people who think that they can, you know, make it through the system unscathed. They turned
right.
on you. They turned on you. They threatened you, and they harassed you physically and financially and legally. But you know, on the surface of it, you're part of their social class, are you not?
Right.
But it didn't matter.
Well, yes and no. It's a complicated story because I never meant to threaten them. I thought I was doing. You know, I thought I was within the lines. And what happened to me was I got framed and, you know, their plans changed and they didn't clue me in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, the question is how and why exactly did we get crossways of each other? Because that
Yeah.
wasn't my goal. It's not, I'm always a person who works, tries to work within the system. And part of the
That could
problem
hurt
was
you.
like, yeah, I
You know,
came up
at
with
some
an egg.
point, somebody decided, like you said, it became personal, and someone decided that you're not on the team, right?
Right.
And they
Well,
need
the
someone like that in order to strengthen themselves. They need a scapegoat.
right. So
But it's
there
very
was an
curious that,
economic.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
I think the problem was they didn't expect me to come up with an economic model that was as powerful as what I came up with. So
Yeah, well,
they
maybe
had
that
me
wasn't
pro.
really part of the goal. Maybe they wanted sort of a weakened one instead of something that was actually I
Well,
mean,
they.
it's a common problem, you know, you're just too good. You
Well,
were just
they wanted the model. So I was prototyping. I think they wanted the model and the knowledge. But the problem with is until they had the free-range totalitarian system in place, the danger was my model could go viral and mess everything up.
I see. And of
And
course,
it
the
was
whole
just.
idea is to monopolize a technology or knowledge or a
Right.
model, right? You want to
Right.
be a you want to be in exclusive control of it, and
Right.
this could completely
Right.
undermine that monopoly.
Right. And now that they have the free-range totalitarian system set up, I think they're in a different place. Well, anyway, so if you go
Yeah.
back and you look at Harvard Endowment, and I use Harvard just because I know it, as a result of doing that research, basically you had the endowment running around the world and doing the rape of Russia or the housing bubble here and making a fortune doing it, or Enron, which I suspect was laundering the money that was disappearing out of the US government. And it's making a fortune doing it. But it's tax-free. So it's creating, $27 trillion of bailouts for the taxpayers, but it's not having to contribute. So it's doing the damage. The taxpayers have to pay the damage, but it has a get out of jail free card because it doesn't have to pay taxes. And of course, where I really ruffled feathers is I started writing people and saying, well, why should Harvard have a tax exemption if it's just going to engage in disaster capitalism all over the world and cost the taxpayers a fortune? Shouldn't they have to pay to clean up the messes they make at a minimum? Or maybe even better, they stop making the messes. But one thing it led me to, and I was so surprised and pleased that you brought up the Vatican, is essentially I see these guys as competing against the Ma Vatican model, which is the alternate financial model on the planet, because you've got 2,000 years of tax-free operation and diplomatic immunity. I mean, Harvard has the tax-free, and it has the cycling of the human and intellectual capital, but it doesn't have that diplomatic immunity. And when you
Well,
come
it's
up against.
interesting you should mention that because the problem that I have encountered with my attorney in going after the University of California is that it is a government within a government, just like the
Right.
Vatican is a sovereign nation within a nation. And I don't know the situation in Massachusetts in the case of Harvard, but I'll bet you anything they have some sort of special status within the Massachusetts state charter or the state constitution. That seems to be the real key to how these people can get away with it. They are sovereign. They have their own form of sovereignty within civil government, and that has to end. That has to be exposed, and it has to be overturned.
Well, it's interesting because the Harvard Endowment was very tied in to the State Department, and in fact, it was a Harvard cutout endowment cutout that was financing the biggest defense contractor at State, the biggest contractor who ran the mail pouch system.
Yeah. So
So
I
I
think we have to
suspect,
look at both the private and the public
yeah.
university systems as simply tentacles of this larger
Yeah.
complex we're talking about. And I had a question for you,
Yeah.
Catherine. Now we talked about the Vatican and the university as being separate entity, but has it ever occurred to you that perhaps the universities, not just in the U.S. but in Mexico and in Europe, are extensions of the Vatican, in terms
Well,
of
that's a
finances and
right.
governance as well?
That's a big question I've looked into because at the end of the Revolutionary War, one of the things that perpetuated the model was it was decided after the war that the original university charters would be upheld.
Uh-huh.
And so the Revolutionary War didn't tear them up, and they continued. And
I
think that's a very important part of the legal history. And then the question comes back to, okay, how did those charters relate to both the Church of England and the Vatican and the monarchy? And I don't know the answer, but I would love to see research happen on that whole.
I think you're on to something very, very important, and I'm going to put that idea into the minds of young academics who want to do some research. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, after all, look at the original name of Columbia University was Queen's College, right?
Right.
College of William and Mary. I mean, the whole monarchical system is imprinted on that, as well as the Society of Jesus imprint, Georgetown, Notre Dame, you name
right.
it. In the case of the University of California, man, talk about Society of Jesus. Look at the personnel, Janet Napolitano, second generation, Jerry
right.
Brown, Jr., you name it. So
right.
anyway, there are some imperial, and this is not some sort of anti-papist screed that I'm on here. I'm just saying that this is definitely, you know, if where there's smoke, there's fire, as they say.
Right.
And it's,
so
it's
let me,
we have to
let
check
me just
into it. Yeah, go ahead.
Tell you one other insight, two other insights, which I think you will appreciate, which I think are very important to what I call the war of the models. If you look at the Vatican model, in addition mm-hmm. to the diplomatic immunity and the tax exemption, they had the ultimate control file system. You had a storefront church everywhere and a confessional booth.
Uh-huh.
And you had a network of thousands of priests collecting dossiers on everyone.
Wow, mental health specialists, like they have on my store. We have a psychotherapist. You have to go in there to confess your sins.
Right.
serious.
And so if you look at the Masons, I think for centuries the Masons were trying to figure out, you know, because they could never beat the control file system that the Vatican had
mm-hmm.
and the Catholic Church had. So they tried psychotherapy. This is the Masons and the bankers. They tried psychotherapy, but when digital technology came along and they came up with sort of the free range totalitarian system through the information systems.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the Catholic Church started to take the blame on pedophilia and everything else. And
I
what
see.
You've seen is the telco system has basically pulled the rug out from under the Vatican's global control file system.
So that's why these people are being thrown under the bus.
Right. And what's interesting is if you look in the areas where I'm familiar historically with the whole pedophilia scandals,
mm-hmm.
all of those scandals, which were very much a joint venture of the church, the Masons, and the intelligence agencies, the church is taking the 100% fall for them. It's quite amazing.
True. The other people are getting off free.
Right. And because the other people have the telcos.
And telco stands for what? What is an acronym for?
Telecommunication telco? Company.
Oh, okay, right. So we have, and that would be Facebook and Twitter and that.
Right. So you've created, there's one academic at Harvard who calls it surveillance capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
You've created this surveillance capitalism network that is more economic. You see, the storefront churches created the control file, but they also tithed. And so it's a for-profit way, you know, it's a cash flow positive way to create control files. You don't have to, it's not an expense. The telecommunication networks have come up with something that's much cheaper than running the storefront churches and creates a lot more money for you because you've now integrated it in with your ability to sell consumer products and investments and everything else and deliver entrainment technology.
And
so
it's,
the church now
non-denominational. It doesn't discriminate on the basis of and it's pervasive. And it's Facebook.
Right.
And it's Google. And it's Amazon.com.
The church is really getting outcompeted here. And it's very interesting
Again,
to watch.
Again, Catherine, I never underestimate the power of full-time brilliant thinkers.
Me too.
Who are associated with the Vatican. I mean, these are priests. They, you know, talk about being spotted, groomed, and tapped for intrigue. That's the priesthood there. What if all this this telecom is an extension of the Vatican? I don't mean to be like, okay, it's all of the Roman Catholic.
You know something? It could just be a centralization move by the Vatican. You know, there's no way to tell because here's the reality. We don't see the governance system on planet Earth clearly. And until we do, anything's possible.
Yeah.
So
all options are open.
Exactly.
And we can only really sniff it out as if we study the history and we get testimonials from insiders like yourself and people who are able to break it down. But the ultimate goal is to find some space within this tyranny for ourselves. That's really the process. I mean, I don't have any illusions about undermining Vatican power, the University of California.
Right.
But they want it all. That's the problem. They don't want 95%. They want 100%.
Well, I'm an optimist. I don't think it will work, but I think bringing transparency to it really helps accelerate inspiring people to find alternatives and not, you know, my big concern is I don't want to see subscribers lose time or money because they didn't have an accurate map of reality.
Absolutely.
So, I'm hoping that transparency can help people make their own choices.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want them to have to spend as much time and money figuring this out as I had to.
No. You don't want them to be victimized by some high-level, sophisticated bust-out scheme?
Right.
No, that's not going to be fun.
So one more insight, and then I want to ask you a question.
Please.
The other insight is, in my experience, I've had many different sort of anecdotal experiences and then people telling me this to say that in the big cities, the Masons had made a strategic decision in the 60s that they were going to start moving all their operations into the universities because in a world where you're promoting sexual equality and diversity, you needed a way to have meetings that, you know, wasn't a whole bunch of white guys going off and meeting alone in the temple. That was too obvious. And instead, you could do it around all the sports games. You know, everybody goes to Notre Dame for the football game, you know, and then you just happen to co-locate all those meetings. And so they felt that the way to organize a lot of the collaboration cross-sector instead of going down to the temple was or have secret meetings was to do it around the universities.
Well, I think they've been doing that since the university was invented or developed in the medieval period.
No, I agree.
And that's an extension of that, yeah. And that's where a lot of the pedophilia complex is centralized as well, as we saw in Penn State. And I have a sneaking suspicion that something similar on a much larger level is going to break at the University of California. I think that's one of the reasons why they're really, really clamping down on me. The signs are all there. There's a sexual deviant underground amongst the University of California, according to my own personal private research and investigations, amongst high-level University of California personnel at my campus and otherwise, because that is the glue that binds them together in this little secret society that they've developed for themselves.
Right. It's and it has done that for centuries in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's much worse than many people understand.
Right, and it used to be, you know, back a few decades ago, if you were accused of being gay or lesbian, that could ruin your career, right?
Right.
That's been normalized, so they have to up the ante and make pedophilia the next phase. And by the way, that is also en route in academic research that I'm reading, en route to being normalized as well. So what's going to be the next phase? Human sacrifice, you know, which might be taking place. But, they call it intergenerational intimacy. I mean, they have the American Psychological Association publishing articles that say, hey, you know, sexual relations between adults and children aren't really that, quote-unquote, traumatic. This is serious research. And that's another function that the university plays, which is to normalize deviance, to normalize criminality, to turn everything on its head.
Right. Well, let's turn a little bit to Wall Street.
Please.
Talk a little bit about what you've observed as the relationship between the big universities and Wall Street.
Well, the major warning that I've been trying to share with my colleagues who have turned a deaf ear to me is the bust out of the University of California pension. And the warning signs came a few years ago when the whole I know there's a group of them, consultants, or I guess they were salaried people at headquarters, were fired for, irregularities. And periodically, these scandals break at the University of California. But in general, we know that entire nations, such as Greece, or Iceland, have been put in a position where they have to engage in bail-ins. We've seen other pension funds go bust within the United States. And I think you'd have to draw the conclusion that why would the University of California pension system be immune to that?
Is the University of California part of CalPERS or CalSTRS, or is it separate?
No, it's separate. Yeah,
separate.
And I think CalPERS got hit, didn't they? There was a raid on them. I'm not sure about.
Well,
that.
I don't. Have you ever heard? I'm sure you read my story in the Dylan Reed about the president of CalPERS. He was on a board of mine, a very capable man.
Mm-hmm.
In 1997, and I was working on a model with this group of really very talented pension leaders on how we could re-engineer the federal budget in a way that would not only help dramatically improve the economy of the United States, but help the pension funds really make sure that they could produce the yields that would ensure the baby boomer retirement was, taken care of. And
there
so
are people
I,
like that around and that manage pension funds who you can speak
oh, yeah,
with
yeah,
on
yeah.
that level?
These guys were,
oh, okay. That's good.
These were very caring people and very concerned
wow.
about the long-term strategic. Well, they understood
yeah.
there was no way they could do well if the country went down the drain. So they were very concerned about, okay, how do we manage policy at the highest level, whether investment policy or government infrastructure and other investment, so that mm-hmm. we make sure that our, because they were very worried about how are we going to protect the boomers and
right.
And keep our fiduciary obligations. So, they're very performance-oriented people. Anyway, so I presented my whole presentation. Here's how we take digital technology and integrate it into communities and create enormous equity wealth in places in a way that the pension funds get a huge, gain from the investment. And it was really funny because the head of CalPERS, he almost started crying. His eyes were tearing up. And he looked at me, and he had worked for Saul Alinsky as a young man. And he said, well, this is Saul's model, and they were able to stop him. And I said to him, but they didn't have the internet. Of course, I was being naive. And he looked at me, and he froze, and he said, you don't understand. It's too late. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall. And that was that next fiscal year was October 97, the 1998 federal fiscal year, when the $8.5 trillion started to go missing from the government and all the financial fraud, including in the housing bubble, exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And I had thought he meant they're reallocating the pension money to invest in the emerging markets. What I now realize they're literally illegally, they're pumping and dumping the stock and housing market and sucking money out of the federal government that stockpiled there and moving it abroad illegally. They're basically stealing the retirement savings and getting it out of the old systems now. And in the meantime, now, the reason that's interesting is what it meant was they sat there and then proceeded to buy massive amounts of housing paper. And that meant any losses they experienced on the housing paper and the bust of the housing bubble, they knew, and they knew they were buying rotten paper. They knew. And
but
so,
they wouldn't be around to pay the consequences for that.
Well, I think if they
yeah.
they didn't believe that they had the ability to say no. In other words, there's a national security state, and it orders everybody what they're going to do, and if
sure.
you don't do it, you're going to die or your family's going to die or,
Well, that leads me to the cherry on top of the sundae here, and that is that when they put Janet Napolitano as the head of the University of California president, that's sending a strong signal. Are we
right.
still connected? Oh, yeah, okay. That's
yeah,
sends
yeah.
a strong signal. If you dissent from the bust out, be careful. You know, look over your shoulder. That's the signal that,
right.
Like I said, most of my colleagues are afraid. They don't know why they're afraid, but there's fear signals being sent throughout the entire
right.
system. And that tells me that it's sort of like a weasel that's gone into a hen house and sucked the eggs out there, and the chicken's sitting on a hollowed-out egg. That's what we're in. We're sitting on a hollowed-out egg. I think that the weasels have already absconded with the essence of the egg, and we're just
sitting
on a hollow shell.
They're reinvesting it right here. It's... In other words, the economy is, I call it global 2.0 and 3.0. They left the liabilities in global 2.0, but they got the assets over in global 3.0. And global 3.0 is going, you know, gangbusters. And I'll bet you the Harvard Endowment has big bets on global 3.0.
Well, they should. They created it, right? So
right. Right. Okay, so
wow.
Let's just talk a little bit about solutions. One of the things I... was listening to one of your interviews earlier this week, and you talked about the importance of family.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the economic question, it really comes down to building family wealth, because historically, globally, the family has been the great risk manager and protecting people, you know, and one of the reasons is by providing a pool of financial resources and building family enterprises that really protects everybody in the family. Because everybody's protected because they're a member of the family and they're loved. And again, as you've pointed out, not that it's a perfect institution, it's a human institution. But a lot of this comes down to, will individuals and families be allowed to create that kind of financial freedom? Because that's really what backstops individual freedom, is that capacity. And so I didn't know if you wanted to say anything about families, because I find you very eloquent on that topic, but...
It's a central institution beyond the individual for not just wealth creation, but for your own health, your own
right.
being. As I stated earlier, I teach in Asian American studies. Most of your institutions have huge numbers of Asian Americans. And in talking to my students, almost all of them, their families, their mothers and fathers and their brothers and sisters have small family businesses. The only exception
right.
is the Filipino-Americans who tend to work for the U.S. government because the history of colonialism. But the Vietnamese, Chinese-American, less so Japanese-American, but if they're refugee and immigrant stock, they are very much tied in to the family-centered model of society, which it should be. And as you know, as an economist, that was really the basis of American wealth and prosperity.
Right.
And as you know now, as you alluded to just a moment ago, the government and with its regulations, taxation scheme is purposely trying to erode that so that we'll all be wards of the government in some fashion.
Right.
Now, they also have, and I'm not encouraging illegality, but they also, these students of mine, their families have businesses that are cash and carry, like restaurants, right?
Right?
There's cash
right.
money. And
right.
so in a sense, they're kind of free of the direct taxation scheme that I'm locked into as a salaried employee. So I said, hey, listen, talk to your dad and your mother, and they'll really appreciate you trying to learn a little bit more about the family business and start thinking about how you can replicate. You know, you don't have to sell food.
Yeah.
You could be something else. But just use that structure, that model, and that culture with you. That's not a liability, because they come to the university and they try to school that out of them, say, no, you have
no,
to go to corporate.
Don't let that school out, yeah.
No. Look into the past. The past is the future. So I encourage that, and of course that puts me out of alignment with their dreams and their hopes, which, you know, they want to enter into the white collar workforce, and I told them that is ending. That whole
yes.
world is, you know, they've already hollowed out industry, and the next is the great American professional class. Sorry, it's going on. You've seen the news about Disney.
Yeah.
Very specialized workers. They're training their replacements from Asia.
Right.
And
right.
they're being paid at a much lower rate. So I bring all this information to them, but, you know, I don't think it really registers until a person is really in the barrel. You know, once it hits them in the face, then they will learn.
Right.
But until
right.
that point, I agree with you. We can provide people with the best information and intelligence and analysis as possible, and then let them make the decision.
Right, but you're right. They need a vision. They need a vision of something much more wonderful.
They do.
You know, than working for a big corporation. And so that's
why
right. I think alternative visions are so important. So I've used up a lot of your time. What I want you to talk about next is, you're a subscriber to Salir, you're listening to this. How do someone listening to this interview learn more about your work and access more interviews and discussion with you? Because there's a wealth of great stuff on the internet. But if you could just introduce us to it, and how do we support you in what you're doing? Because I just think what you're doing is so wonderful and so necessary. And I, well, you know, when I found you, I thought, oh, I'm not alone in the universe.
Oh, no, I've been following your work, Catherine, for a long time, and I saw you in person giving a great talk at the Zero Point Energy Conference in San Mateo, California, a couple of years ago.
Now, that was the Secret Space Program.
Oh, the Secret Space, I'm sorry. Yeah,
but Secret, they, you know. I wish you had come and introduced yourself. I didn't realize you were in the audience.
Oh, no, I came up there and I gave you my business card, but you were just coming off the platform. Yeah, yeah.
You
do your talk, so, you know, I understand how conferences work. So.
Oh, my God, I can't believe I missed that opportunity.
Oh, yeah, we met. Yeah, we shook hands and everything.
Okay.
So
that,
there you go.
Okay.
And so thank you very much for your support in that. Number one, you can subscribers can contact me directly at the Daryl, D.Y. Hamamoto at UC Davis. My address is out there. And from there, we'll move the conversation probably to my private email account because I don't want Janet Napolitano to look at it. You can find me on Facebook. Oh, yes, there's a big scandal right now about her spying on our correspondence. And they created the university created their own security breach, and they solved the problem by saying, okay, we're going to spy on everybody so it doesn't happen again, right? A false flag. That's, we know their MO now, right? Because we watch YouTube programs and such. And I'm on YouTube. I have my own YouTube channel. It's called Professor Hamamoto. It's kind of a smart aleck, parodic, wide-ranging, free-ranging type of take on culture, society, and my own obsessions. That's about it. My larger ambition is to do a news and analysis in my own online-oriented show with a little bit of live music, entertainment.
Oh, wonderful.
Right?
Yeah.
So if you have any investors there who want to bet on a winner, which would be me, please have them contact me. And because I'm going to fulfill my destiny, which is to die comfortably before Janet Napolitano can get to me. So there's that, and maintain your, you have a nice hearty laugh, and I like it.
Uh-huh.
Maintain that, not you, but your subscribers. Yeah. Be around people who make you happy and make you laugh and have joy in life and what they're doing, because life is short, and there are a lot of people there who are trying to make it shorter for us. So we're going to defeat these bad people. And we're going to laugh at them and say, who's the sucker now, right?
Listen, Carolyn Casey has a wonderful
expression. Hell. You went through hell. They threw everything that they could, and you are on your feet. You were not even bent, let alone
bowed. Well,
here's
the funny thing. All my life, I kept my dream was always to find a way out.
Oh,
and my
okay.
theory of how I was going to get out was I would – they always said they had to do all these bad things because it made money. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to find a way for them to make more money, doing human things than inhuman.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to find a way they can make more money making a neighborhood wonderful than destroying it.
Right.
And I think they thought I was just being silly, but I found one. And and what happened was then I got thrown out. And the beauty of it is, when you, I'm a Christian, so I'll use Christian talk. When you ask God to give you something, i.e. get me out, it's really important to, to also specify you want a comfortable, a comfortable process. Because in essence, I got what I wanted, which was I got out.
Yeah.
And I got out, not because I tried to get out, but because they threw me out. And so now.
That was a gift to you.
It was a huge gift.
It was
a
blessing.
Right. I never broke the rules. It turned out that they had broken, if you look at what happened, it was some of them that broke the rules and they lied to others, some of them. And, anyway, it's a complicated story. But so now I'm out and I'm not guilty of breaking the rules. And it's kind of a very unusual situation. But I feel very, I said to a subscriber yesterday, thank you for the opportunity to work for you instead of the people I used to work for.
No, that goes back to my my earlier point. Be around the people that make you feel good and you can trust and love. That's really what it's all about. And these people are very unhappy. And because they're so unhappy, they wanted to bring you down. And they want to bring anybody down who's having too good of a time, who are healthy, who are intelligent, ambitious, and have a lot of energy. They want to bring us down to their level. Don't let it happen. And you allude to faith, and you don't do a lot of God talk in your writing and such. But it's very, very important. That's something that I've really rejoined and got in touch with back for the last 3 years or so. During this torment that they're trying to inflict on me. And believe me, it does work. It's important.
It really does. It really does.
Yes. Very, very important.
Okay. Well, Professor Daryl Hamamoto, we are huge fans, and we want you to, anything we can do to support and help you going forward, you just let us know, okay?
I appreciate that, Catherine. Thank you so much.
And if you ever walk up to me in person, I'm going to grab you and we're going to go have lunch. I will never miss that opportunity again.
Oh, absolutely. And the next time you're in the Bay Area, please, let's get together.
Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. Have a great day. Bye.
You too now. Bye-bye.